Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, to our April free-for-all. For those that are joining us live, most of y'all are regulars. As you know, a great thing about our free-for-alls is we have open topic, open phones. So if you're with us live, you go up to the top of the show page, you'll see the studio line if you want to call in and throw your question, or you can go into the chat room at the bottom of the page, and if there's some topics or some subjects that you would want to us to talk about in the maritime and national security realm, that would be a great place to do it, because we've got our little list of things we want to chat about, but maybe there's something to be in your bonnet, a burr in your saddle that you wanted us to chat about. Hey, you put it in there, we'll do our best to get around to it. And I always like to put the invitation out there that if you don't already, because life is busy and you can't always be with us live or stay with us for the full hour, you can go over to iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, wherever you get your podcasts, and look for Midrats and go ahead and subscribe. And that way the podcast will be ready for you at a time better for your entertainment value. But hey, Eagle One, glad to talk to you this afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how are you doing?
I'm better than I deserve, though. I do have a little bit of a bone to pick with North Carolina today. I usually try to keep our southern harmony in focus, but I got a little bait-and-switch issue that is kind of disturbing. But I found a little bit of a way to recapture a little bit of my lost honor here by this misrepresentation by the tobacco state. On Netflix, I was scrolling for something that looked more interesting than anything else being offered. And lo and behold, there was a limited run series called Florida Man. I was like, okay, I kind of like C-list actors on a low budget and making fun stuff. Let's go see what Florida Man's about. This is kind of a murder mystery. I don't know. That'll work. So I'm watching it, and I'm sitting there with my wonderful and patient spouse, and we're going, okay, trying to identify these spots. That could be over in the Big Bend area, maybe somewhere between Cedar Key and Homosassa, or could that be around south of Daytona, maybe around Pellisher Creek? I don't recognize this stuff. Well, they're filming it in North Carolina, up in the Outer Banks in Wilmington. So congratulations, North Carolina. All the bad things about Florida Man, you can now claim credit for.
Well, I hope it's a revenue generator, but Wilmington is a pretty big spot for cinema and TV shows. I think there are a number of them were filmed there.
I think it's kind of like Atlanta in the South. It's something that it's affordable to go to. There's lots of different venues. There's a friendly government. They're not going to beat you upside the head and shoulders with taxes. I will say, though, because I've described for people for a year, mostly in a culinary context, but culturally, I think it's accurate, too, that there is a subculture in the South, the coastal South, the Jimmy Buffett South, however you want to look at it, that kind of goes from Wilmington, North Carolina, down the East Coast to Daytona Beach. And you can say it has a sister culture, I think, from right north of Tampa, going counterclockwise across the Big Bend of Florida, through Pensacola, up to Mobile, which is, you know, the Redneck Riviera. It's similar but different food, that coastal southern. So it looks the salt marshes of coastal Wilmington and the Outer Banks is not dissimilar from that northern part of the East Coast before you hit the mangroves of Florida. So I guess it is cheaper than in Florida. And there aren't that many places left on the coast that you can kind of get some of the filming they're doing. So anyway, I've only into two episodes. If anybody's looking for, I wouldn't say it's marshmallow, but it's not high maintenance to watch.
Everybody needs a little bit of fluff.
Well, you're considering what we usually talk about here on the show.
Yeah.
We don't do fluff topics here. So anyway, I because it's a free for all and we own the territory, so to speak, I just thought I would bring that up. But I wanted to.
Well, you should also mention. I'm going to interrupt you. You should also mention that the USS North Carolina is down in Wilmington, and that's a very good ship to tour if you want to see what the big old battleships were like.
Yeah, I know Texas is in dry dock right now, getting some work done. Thank goodness. But yeah, the Texas, the North Carolina, the Alabama, when you go through Mobile. Those are just some great warships, some great stories. You know, most people, you know, think about the Missouri over in Hawaii and stuff, but if you want to get on an old battle wagon, you don't have to travel that far. You can, if you're near Mobile, Houston, or Wilmington, and I would say the USS North Carolina would be, if you had to do a destination, I'd rather, Wilmington is just, I don't want to upset anybody from Mobile, but, Wilmington, North Carolina, that area, it is one of the more pleasant parts of the country to be in. It's not as crowded or have issues as you have with Houston. It's definitely within striking range of Norfolk and places like that. It's a nice place to go. A couple of friends of mine have the vacation houses off in the Outer Banks too. It's also a pretty good giveaway, but I don't know if you want us to advertise and have more people showing up.
No, as long as they don't stay, it's fine. We welcome everybody as long as they go home. You know, the other place that's got some interesting ships is Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, where Patriots Point is. They have an aircraft carrier and the USS Leahy, I think, the one that the destroyer that or destroyer escort that took six kamikaze hits in World War II and came home. So, what it's worth.
It would not sink.
There you go.
Yeah. That's,
all right.
That's
so let's talk about something meaningful.
Well, let's just go ahead and go for the top rung, so to speak. I kind of went down a rabbit hole this week that I hope everybody will be patient with me on. But I had a person tap me on the shoulder this week when Admiral Aquilino was up on the Hill giving testimony in front of the House and Senate. And I got to generate taxable income, so I was a little busy. I wasn't watching it in real time. And since then, I've tried to grab what I can based upon some of the taps on the shoulder that I got. And Aquilino, he's one of those guys that I guess in a way you've got to tap your hat to him, and that he's got a little bit of luck, a little bit of hard work, I guess. But he was PAC Fleet when the Bonhomme Richard burned. He was also in the mix there and with the Roosevelt in 2020. With the COVID kerfuffle, and he emerged from both of those events unscathed. Obviously, he was promoted up, but he had two things that he commented on that I kind of wanted to talk about. One was some questioning that he got from specifically Representative Gallagher about our inventory of weapons, something that we've talked about, you know, for years here, but as we've talked about it a few times in the context of the lessons that the Russo-Ukrainian war is trying to tap everybody on the shoulder about what you buy in peace versus what you need at war if you're going to go more than 72 hours. And the second issue had to do with a very strange comment that he said in response to a question by DeLuzio, Pennsylvania representative. I'll get his name right during the break when I look at my sheet. But I got actually a little fancy here. And I got an audio clip that I wanted to bring up, and then we can talk about the first issue. And I'd ask everybody as they listen, the video is a little better because you can get a little bit of facial tells from Admiral Aquilino, but you can also hear the audio as well. This is an exchange. Representative Gallagher had brought up some of the war games that they were going to be doing and some of the lessons that they had, specifically about inventory and the depth or lack thereof of our magazines. So there's a little bit of talk about wargaming, but it's a comment towards the end that I want everybody to kind of focus on.
One thing quickly becomes apparent. We go Winchester on critical weapon systems. We run out of long-range fires in particular. I would be curious to get your view on that. What worries you about the stockpiles of long-range fires that we have west of the international dateline, and what do you think is our best way to start replenishing our stockpiles and make sure that you have what you need in theater prior to the shooting starting?
So thanks, Congressman. First, let me just make sure, I want to make sure how you know I look at war games, right? Wargaming is a learning objective. So when people talk about, hey, who won, who lost, wargaming is not about that. It's about learning and understanding vulnerabilities, strengths, and helps you go forward and figure out how to adjust and what you might need. So when you go into this event, I hope they're looking at it in the same way. With regard to the munitions piece, again, I'd like to talk in a classified setting over the specific issues. That said, I'm not too worried as it applies to our ability to deter and then deliver effective contingency operations if required.
You're not too worried?
I am not worried. What I would like is the acceleration of those things identified in the budget. And then in my 1254 report, I've made those requirements be known.
You also can key in on Representative Gallagher's tone. He's a little bit incredulous. And I think for good reasons that we've discussed here and others have talked about. And there's kind of a meta issue here besides this specific issue. It's first of all, nobody who's knowledgeable of this issue believes that. And I don't think people think that Admiral Aquilino believes that. And I think what we're seeing, and, you know, this is an issue that it's hard when you get at that level. Back at the end of March, Chairman of Joint Chief Staff General Milley, in an interview over at Defense One, a lot of people wrote about it at the time, he wanted everybody to lower the rhetoric on China. I don't know if this is Aquilino taking marching orders or interpreting that he needs to soft sell China, and specifically whether we need to be worried about China, if that's part of lowering the rhetoric. There's a problem, and you know, maybe we talk about recruiting and it has something to do with that, with the credibility of the military, that we don't have much capital left to be going up there and saying things that just do not reflect reality. I do not know a serious person who, quote, is not worried, unquote. And we know what we need, and Congress is the one that's going to cut the checks. So if we have our senior leaders in uniform perhaps going too far in aligning themselves with the political message of the day, that's for the people who wear civilian outfits to do. Congress, again, is going to look at people in uniform as being handmaids to the politicians that happen to be in the executive branch if they want to downplay that. And if you're not saying that you're worried, then why should Congress give us any more money to build TLAMs? Like, well, what are we building, 117 next year? That's almost one-third of a 1998 Desert Fox strike on Iraq. That's keeping a production line open. We can't talk about how we need to be serious if we're not going to talk serious. Tell me what I'm missing here, but in his tone, I could almost tell that Aquilino, he really just doesn't believe it. He just feels that for whatever reason, he has to believe it.
Yeah, I think his initial response is the key, though. you know, I'm not too worried. I don't know, I don't know what would, make him worry. But, in his position, he can't say, oh, yeah, we've got enough stuff to last an hour and a half. what does that tell anybody who's willing to test us? I think he has to be asked, and this is part of the problem of being in his position, I think, is that he probably had to be really careful not to say, yeah, we're screwed. I would prefer that, I'm sure in private and all the other things he knows, but I don't think that it behooves any of these senior officials to go out and say, we really screwed up in the past, and it's going to take us 10 years to catch up. You have to put a more positive spin on it than that to be in his position, I think. So the position is, I'm not too worried, and if you give me all the money and the stuff that I gave you on my list, then I'll be a lot less worried. But I think that's a challenge.
I think, and again, you're not being paranoid if people are trying to get you, and but his mention of deter, I think, is important because the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Hicks, she and others like her have been pushing for years that the best way to address the threat from China is to convince them that we'll defeat them in 72 hours. When you have that construct and that mindset, okay, what can we throw at them in 72 hours? That's what we need to have. The Russians thought they would take Kiev inside of 72 hours. You always have to, and he's right about war games. They're teaching opportunities, and they ask good questions. And one of the things about war games is you challenge assumptions. So, okay, this assumption that we planned on is now invalid. How do we respond to that? What's our branch plan if this does not work? So at the 72-hour mark, really? Okay, now what are you going to do if all you've done has been focused on deterring by trying to look how scary you are, which it's contrary to Chinese history that goes back thousands of years. They make the Russians look sensitive about casualties. They're very tough. They can absorb a lot, even with their demographics. They have four times the population that we do. And talking what we've learned in Ukraine about the fact that we have no Stinger production line. It's going to take a while to bring it back on board. We're sending as much artillery ammunition, other weapons and HIMARS that we're spending. And people need to be careful about looking at the Taiwan conflict, if it comes to pass, in isolation, saying it's only going to take place in Taiwan. This is where some people that I respect have kind of been caught in this trap, where they will say, well, the battle on Taiwan, if it gets to the point that you're worried about HIMARS or something like that, then it's over. No, that's not true. You can't predict it like that. And also, you cannot assume that a conflict in Taiwan is going to be isolated to Taiwan. There are very few occurrences in world history where two major powers got into a scrap over a lesser power, and it did not metastasize into other areas. Everybody here can pick whatever other flashpoint on the Chinese border it might leak over to, and that's what we need to be thinking about. So I think that I'm not saying Aquilino is lying. I'm saying though that his response requires the validation and the airtightness of a few very, very brittle assumptions that, should it fall through, could be very dangerous for our nation, especially if that is used to not purchase what would need to be purchased in order to be ready. I think it's another lost opportunity where we could have advocated for additional high demand, low density assets out there that we're going to need.
Yeah, again, I think that those questions make good political theater, and I don't see how he could answer it. You know, as honestly as you and I might wish that sometimes people would be honest in that position, but you know, he's got political and diplomatic responsibilities that I think kind of force him into these odd responses. You know, yeah, I'm not too worried. We have enough to deter. Deter what? You know, I mean, and how long do you expect deterrence to last? If are the Chinese trying to build such an overwhelming force that there is no deterrence possible, that we know that they're going to be able to accomplish whatever it is they choose? You know, I think there's so many, I think it's just a problem for the senior leadership. And we've seen what happens sometimes when our senior leaders, both civilian and military, get a little too candid sometimes, and it causes as many problems, if not more problems, than if they just kind of put the best face they can on the situation they're in and move along while hoping that Congress gives them the money to meet some of the needs that have been identified in other ways and at other times.
Yeah, I think you're right. We saw a little example of that where he's trying to, you know, he's in a difficult spot because in the background, and again, I reserve the right to be wrong here. I think the argument is being overplayed on both sides about we can't give aid to Ukraine without critically undermining any ability to help Taiwan defend themselves. Well, as Lincoln said, one war at a time. There's a war that we're engaged in. It's a proxy fight. Everybody should be on board with that now. We are having the Ukrainians minimize the Russian military. They didn't start the fight, but we can help them continue it. And Aquilino was also over at the Senate, and Senator Ernst asked him, quote, has our support to Ukraine depleted any munitions needed for Taiwan, unquote. That was kind of a setup question. He's kind of in a corner, and Admiral Aquilino replied, quote, not at this time, unquote. It's been a great follow-up question. Okay, at what time does it? If you're looking at what we're sending from HIMARS, Javelin, Stingers, Patriots, Harpoons, now the ground launch small diameter bomb, which is it's a sexy little thing, and of course all the 155%. Of course, it's making an impact, but I think he's worked with his messaging people to go, well, you can't say that because then they're going to say, so do we need to stop giving aid to Taiwan? So they're trying to put him in a corner to be used for political purposes. So I think you have a point that he's kind of in a no-win situation. But that doesn't stop people outside like us and people who have larger microphones from perhaps pointing out some of these shortfalls in the argument that's being made.
Well, I think a lot of it depends too on whether we talk about a lot of stuff. The war in Ukraine is a land war. It is. There are, riverine considerations. There is the Black Sea stuff, but it is essentially a land war, and the weapons you use for that are different than the weapons I believe if there's an engagement involving Taiwan or in China in any of that area out there. What's the line from In Harm's Way? It's a mother loving Navy war. I mean, it is. That is a Navy war. Are we seriously contemplating engaging in a land war in Asia? You know, are we going to invade China if they invade Taiwan? I just don't. I'm trying to wrap my mind around why people are upset about equipment that is suitable for land war stuff when we really need to be focusing on the fact that's going to be a Navy war. It's going to be a Navy and Marine Corps war. If the Marine Corps have their distribution system the way they want to have it. But the other powers out there, the Japanese and the Australians and all, you know, I don't think they're looking at gosh, we've got to be ready to send troops into Shanghai or whatever it's called now to protect what we've got. I mean, we're trying to keep, as I perceive it, we're trying to keep China from doing something really stupid and causing a lot of harm to a system because they've got a mindset that their way is the way, and they want everybody to conform to their standard. Well, good gosh, judging by the number of misrepresentations of law and fact they make every day, I'm not sure they would be really happy with the world like that. But, I think it's a Navy thing, and I think that is the focus that Admiral Aquilino is – if I were to guess what he's thinking, and this is pure speculation on my part, is, look, you know, I've got ships. They may not be all the ships I need. They may not be as somebody in the – chat room says not enough tubes. Lee says that not enough tubes to shoot from, but he's got what he's got, you know, and if we don't strip the forces from the Mediterranean and from the other areas we're involved in, then we can do that. We can get more tubes out there, but it is a question of time because it is mentioned many times, it's a big ocean and it takes a long time to get there. And I think somebody else, I mean, we're talking about sustainment and stuff. You know, people keep telling me, well, we don't have enough escorts to get the ships, the sustainment forces flowing to that region. And I've argued before, and I'll continue to do this. I don't think that the Chinese are going to go out of their turf and try and interdict a bunch of shipping from the west coast of the U.S. to Hawaii, or from Hawaii sort of near Guam. You know, I mean, there's 2,000 miles of ocean in there, but they've got to come a long way to get to that point, and then they've got to evade our various systems for detecting them, and then they've got to put up with our marine patrol aircraft systems, the other equipment we have to make their life miserable. I think, and I don't think they're going to have any air power that's going to go out that direction either. So I think the escort ship issue kind of, we don't need that in the initial phase from U.S. to Hawaii. And then the question is, well, how about Hawaii on? And that's a little tougher, but there is some point where you can draw a circle in the ocean. You know, this is the area we begin to start to worry about that. And again, we got these longer range MPAs that can be out there for a while at 1,000 mile P8, I think, at 4 hours is kind of their thing. But the distance between, like Wake and Guam and Guam and Wake in Hawaii, it's enough that you can run aircraft from both directions to support and escort any sustainment shipping. And that's not to say that we have enough tankers and other assets we would need, but it I just think we worry too much about sometimes about the War II model of escorting stuff. We're not in World War II now. We've got a whole different mess we need to be playing with, and we need to be thinking about modern equipment, you know, unmanned escort vessels, high altitude, electric, big gliders. I remember the Gossamer Condor or whatever the thing is, you know, things that can stay up forever. You know, we got all kinds of assets we can throw in the path out there to detect bad guys who would interfere with us trying to sustain our forces. The real issues, of course, are, you know, Guam is vulnerable. How far out do you have to go? Do you go to Wake? Do you try and revitalize? Are we going to try and maintain some kind of presence on the far reaches of the Hawaiian Islands, down in Johnson Atoll and all these other places that are out there? I mean, we've got enough issues to be looking at and where we can pace our forces if we really had to do it, but I don't think the initial escorting of those sustainment ships is a key issue right now.
Yeah, you can almost see a threat gradient is the closer you get to, the color really starts changing when you get west of Guam, but it even starts to tick up when you get to Guam. And you made the comment about sustainment and our ability to keep the fight going west of the international dateline. And I think that was another opportunity that in a different exchange, I don't have the audio for this one. I looked for it, but I couldn't find it, that I talked about briefly at the beginning with Representative DeLuzio of Pennsylvania. He asked Aquilina, quote, where is our sea lift capacity relative to the PRC? And Aquilino responded in part, we have a distinct advantage over the PRC in numbers and capability, unquote. That, to me, that is telling the person that gives you money, you don't need to give me any more money for additional sea lift. I know of no serious person who believes, especially with the interior lines that China operates under west of Guam, that we have any distinct advantage over the Chinese in a conflict inside the first island chain when it comes to sustainment and sea lift. Maybe if you're looking strictly at gray holes, or maybe you're looking at global sustainment, that's fine. But when you're talking about getting close to China, their merchant fleet, their maritime militia, they have so much of the waterway there flooded with their ships. I don't know what point he was making there, but I don't think it was constructive for those that are trying to get additional sea lift and additional auxiliaries to support the fleet west of the International Date Line.
Yeah, I can't. I was trying to think of that same, after I heard that quote, I went, well, how in the world do you come to that conclusion? And I think you hit on part of the answer was that he sees, I think, somewhere that he's got his own, if China's got these short, what did you call it, the interior lines of communication, he's saying the same thing. I've got some kind of short interior line of communication here. If Guam holds, if Saipan can be used, if Mog or Tinian can be used, if the Australia can be used, you know, we're not having to, it's not always the 8,000 mile line. Now, you know, all the MSC guys and everybody who understands this stuff goes, well, yeah, but where are those other ships going to, you know, to get the stuff to those places going to come from? And that is the question that bothers me. And I'm not sure that is well thought out by our planners sometimes, that they don't remember that during World War II that part of the Japanese effort was to, if they could seize the Solomons, if they could succeed in that they could cut off Australia from us pretty well. So, you know, so I know other people have studied World War II and they understand that things how tough things used to be, but if we're talking big tankers coming out of Nigeria, out of Texas, they're going to come around the end of Africa and charge through the Indian Ocean and get to some of our allies. I'm really curious as to how, not having seen the, and I hope I never do see the op plans for this. I know somebody's got to be thinking about this, and I don't understand what his statement was meant to convey, except maybe he thinks he's got an interior lines of communication that work for him too. Although, and I should have said this earlier, closure of the Red Hill facility in Hawaii, and I don't think we've replaced that facility with the tanker out there to take the place of that structure. I'm really struggling with how we're going to sustain our forces forward, trying to do it the way that unless somebody genius has come up with a much faster and broader approach than I'm looking at right now.
Yeah, the you know, technology has changed and things have advanced, et cetera, and so forth. But I can see Admiral Rickover laughing in the background. When you have a conventionally powered fleet, you've got to keep them fueled. You've got to keep them topped off. And you've got to get weapons forward. I guess if you don't have any weapon, if you don't have a very deep magazine depth and you have no ability to reload at sea, then I guess you don't need the sustainment ships to take them west because everybody's got to go back to San Diego. A little sarcastic. But, hey, we actually have a caller. So area code 651, you're live on MIDRATS. Do you have a question or were you just listening and I embarrassed you?
Just listening for now.
Okay. Yeah, we have that sometimes, but thanks for calling in anyway. Okay, so we didn't have a question. We just had a listener, but that's okay. See, we do actually check if people call in. I did, you know, one of my little pet things that the Navy, and we've had some fun conversations over it, that I've been kind of watching, and you can go, there's a couple of places you actually see the video of it, but the, I think the utility and the use of riverine forces that I love to talk about, we're seeing playing out this weekend. I kind of grinned a bit when the announcement came out. For those not familiar, in its lower reaches and near its estuary, the Dnipro, it's a big river. It's like the Mississippi River between, I don't know, Memphis and New Orleans. It's wide. It's big, and it has some pretty big reservoirs upriver as well. It's not a creek by any stretch. It's not the Potomac. It's a big river. But the Ukrainians have done a, quote, amphibious operation, unquote, where, you know, the old phrase, you do an amphibious operation with the ships you have, not the ships you wish you have. And there's been a little bit of a video posted in what they're doing. And from a distance, they look like 7 to 10 meter ribs. Some of them actually look like commercial boats loaded with light infantry crossing the river from the Ukrainian held to the Russian side, and basically they're just pulling up to docks on people's houses and unloading what they can carry. But that is just a little snapshot of, and we've been giving them some of our leftover or discarded riverine craft as we decommission that again. But it does show, again, that if you have the ability to move forces by sea, it complicates your enemy's calculus on how they're going to defend. They just can't assume that moat's going to last. And when they're concentrating their forces someplace else, it provides opportunities. I saw a couple reports that the Russians had to retreat back to a few miles inland to another smaller river that just looks, you know, maybe 50 to 100 yards wide, vice a half mile wide. So that was just really interesting to see how that plays out. I'm hoping more video will come up. And, again, one of those things that I hope smart people are looking at the lessons that the Ukrainian war is reminding us of, because I think that plays into it as well. You can raise a lot of havoc on your enemy's plans when they can't consider the maritime approaches, even if their fresh water is being secure.
Yeah, I think Washington, something about the Delaware River, Christmas Eve. I think he kind of something. You know, he kind of surprised some people. I don't know why we have to keep learning these lessons, but there's a difference between the forces that do what the Ukrainians are doing by going across the Dnieper there and what the Navy riverine forces were doing, like in Vietnam and in Iraq, the interdiction of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese bad guys, and in Iraq the same thing, trying to interdict people using the waterways for bad purposes as far as our side went. But you know, I look at the what was the movie, the Bridge at Remagen, when they're trying to hold the one bridge, and you know, then there are all these other places where they were loading troops, army guys into army boats, and trying to go across these rivers to capture the other side in World War II. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's a different. It is. I hate to keep throwing things at the land. That's a land war thing, but that is a land war thing as opposed to the blue water Navy, certainly, and the inshore undersea world in the literal. So it's cool that they're doing that, and I'm glad that we gave them these assets, if that's what it is that they're using to do that. But I don't right now I wouldn't see a mission, and I understand why the Navy get rid of some of this stuff, despite the fact that it was really cool stuff. What's the mission that you foresee in the future for a force like that, and where would we use it? And that's how you get your program cut.
You look at, yeah, exactly. Well, you look at the globe. You look at any type of place that has a major riverine type environment. You know, people said we would never need it again, and we decommissioned, I think, our last reserve riverine unit. It was in California in the late 90s. And when we invaded Iraq in 2003, you had the Tigris and Euphrates River that we had no ability to securely project power on until our Army guys creatively acquisitioned a few fishing boats and were able to help secure dams, help interdict some of our opponents who are using the waterways, as they're always used as a way to transport things. I've heard people make the argument that there's no job for these small ships in a conflict with China. It depends upon where that conflict goes. You just don't know. There are too many places in the world that have a nearshore environment that either we or our partner nations will need that capability turnkey and ready to go. Otherwise, we'll have to recreate it again. I think we're very bad where the next conflict will go. So all we can do is look at a map. And when you have major river systems in places we will probably be in a conflict in, we're either going to have that capability or we'll just have to invent it on the fly. And based upon our experience in Iraq, we developed a good group of a nice bit of kit with a lot of flexibility. And now we're getting rid of it again. And I can see the argument. I can actually make the argument if you want to pay me to do it. But I don't think at the end of the day, getting rid of that capability is going to be worth the price of needing it again. I think in the last 200 years, our major conflicts, what did we not need that in? Maybe World War I, we didn't need it in. We definitely needed it in World War II. We used it in Korea to a lesser extent. Definitely in Vietnam, definitely in Iraq. Had no use for it in Afghanistan for obvious reasons. But Spanish-American War, absolutely. U.S. Civil War, oh my gosh, huge, huge play. So I just think it's an interesting discussion point. And I know that the Ukrainians can't get enough of their small ships because they've gotten religion on it as well from a couple things that I've read.
Yeah, if I look at the river systems in Europe, I don't know why. I was trying to look at this up the other day. I was trying to find it. Well, gosh, who's got the river patrol boat stuff that they would need to go down the Danube and all these other fairly large river systems? And I don't think anybody in Europe maintains a riverine force of the kind we had because – I guess we're all in the EU now. We don't need this sort of thing. But I would be looking at that. And I don't know if they have police patrol boats they think are adequate or what. But yeah, I think that maybe our European allies will wake up a little bit to things that could be an issue for them, and that having some kind of riverine force might be to their benefit. And I'm not against the small ships. I think we need tons of them, and I think especially around the Philippines and the other archipelagos out in the near the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea, as I like to call it. Those are really valuable assets, just like the PT boats in World War II were an asset in those very waters and down on the Solomons and other places where they could interdict Japanese barges and all kinds of stuff and do a lot of damage at reasonably low cost for and low risk to a crew of what they have, five or six guys on those things. Anyway.
Well, I've got great news for you. As you might be aware, I troll the Austrian and German military's YouTube channels. They put out some good kit, some good stuff. And, of course, my German's not what it used to be, so I do the auto-translate into English, which does a really good job in translating. And about a year ago, I think it was, the Austrians put out a little video. They do have riverine assault craft, and they were showing one of their exercises. And they use it kind of like what the Ukrainians are doing a lot of, and what was done a lot in Vietnam, where you have special operations forces you need to insert somewhere or you need to extract somebody, come up river, makes a big noise, breaks things, inserts or takes people, and then returns back across the water with you know, just lightly armored but heavily armed assault boats craft. So I know at least the Austrians on the Danube had that capability. They actually used to have they called it a navy, but they decommissioned it, and the army took over the responsibilities. But I think a lot of it just has to do with the fact that they're all in the EU. You know, maybe the Serbians still have something significant, but there's a rudimentary capability there.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, I always have fun when I go to Austria because I train. What's the Austrian Navy? When did they last have a Navy? I guess when they had, you know. So I didn't find any riverine patrol boats in the Austrian Navy, but obviously I wasn't reading, and my German is non-existent, so I wasn't reading about what their army was up to. So,
well, if you talk to a northern German, Austrian isn't real German anyway, so I don't know how much it would help you. Something else that I wanted to talk about today, simply because I found the numbers interesting and a bit shocking, is the recruitment numbers came in, and I'll just go ahead and put it out there. The Marines, as the Marines do, they actually got 100% of their recruiting goal. The Air Force got 87% of their recruiting goal. I guess they include Space Force with that too. Who knows? The Army, 69%. And the U.S. Navy only got 60% of their recruiting goal. And, you know, you would think, and actually you wouldn't think, it's true, that all the barriers that the services face bringing people in, i.e., you have a body of 17 to 22-year-olds you're going to bring in as your enlistment group, plus a few people that are older. You all have that challenges, overweight, drug use, criminal record, desire to serve. That affects everybody equally. So when you have such a disparity from 60% to 100%, and I've heard people say, well, the Marines are special. True, and they're smaller, true, but not in a European sense. Okay, so, you know, take out the Marines. Air Force is pretty big, and the Army is pretty big, and they're doing significantly better than the Navy. So I read a couple of replies from Navy Recruiting Command, and it was just boilerplate PAO production, squid ink, no pun intended. Doesn't really say anything, but I would really be interested to see behind the closed door what is causing, or what are the top 3 to 5 causal factors that makes the Air Force get 87% and the Navy get 60%. That's just a huge disparity.
Well, I think a lot of it has with media coverage. I mean, how many positive stories have we seen about the Navy in the last years? I mean, the Marines are always going to appeal to a certain group of people because of the way they, and their advertising is just terrific. But the Navy, I'm always reminded of join the Navy, and anyway, it was a long time ago. But we've got collisions, we've got near collisions, we've got ships on fire, we've got extended deployments, we've got the number of problems is lengthy. The number of positive spin stories is pretty small. So either our PAOs need to step up and, you know, reveal the good stuff, and I'm not talking about the stuff that appeals to the politicians, but the stuff that would appeal to your average 18-year-old kid who's thinking about joining a service, you know, and it used to be, you know, we would recruit people because we'll give you a career. You know, you come in, we'll train you to do this kind of work. I don't think we even advertise that anymore. Maybe we do, but I'm not sure I see it anywhere. So and one of the most positive movie recently is about the Navy is Top Gun Maverick. Once again, we're dealing with a small, very elite group of fighter pilots. And we don't mention enough about what the crews in the carrier, CIC, air ops stuff going on. But, you know, not enough credits given to those people and what they were doing in support of what Maverick and his kids were trying to do.
And I think you mentioned something that I think has a lot to do with it, is a lot of what you see our Navy doing, who they're trying to talk to seems to be very, very narrow. It's a narrow net on a narrow group of issues. You only have a limited pot of, if you're a leader, personal capital, or if you're a service, institutional capital that you can draw on. So you have to invest and spend that in, you know, very, very careful ways. And obviously we're not doing that well in our various ways of communicating to young men and women who might be interested in serving. If we would, we'd be closer to the Air Force as opposed to being in the background. And you're right, image matters. We've talked about it for years. Other people have as well. You know, nobody is going to say, I want to serve on that ship when it's rusting all over the place. Or you have leaders who say, well, you know, 9-month deployments are the new normal just because. And you have retentions. Evidently, the Navy's retention is actually a little bit better, but that's not reflected in those who are retaining, convincing other people to come join us. You know, the old hometown recruiters type of folks where you go back and get and tell the Navy story. So we're not talking to the right audience. We're not putting out the right messages to bring people in. And what we are doing is not going in the right direction towards a broad enough audience to bring it in. That has got to be a very direct conversation we have with ourselves, both our messaging, our conduct, and our leadership. But I haven't seen that, at least in public. Hopefully it's going to be something in private that's being done. I think that is probably the next chief of naval operations who his responsibility is to train, man, and equip, that maybe he can flop that and focus on personnel and recruiting and doing it in a different way. Because 60% when the U.S. Air Force getting 87%, you know, inter-service rivalries aside, to me that's a red letter underline emphasis that what we're doing now, we need to stop training timeout, recruiting timeout, and we need to do something that works.
Well, as an Air Force brat, I'll tell you that one of the attractions of the Air Force is they don't go anywhere. Well, you know, we did travel a lot and we moved a lot, but you have a fixed base for the most part. Air Force people are not gone for 6-9 months. I mean, they do TTYs and all that stuff, but they're generally not gone for 11-month deployments, or 10-month deployments, or 9-month deployments, and it always seems to me they were a little more, technical in their jobs than some of the positions we have in the Navy or had in the Navy. So that, which isn't true. We have the 18-year-old kid fixing jet airplanes, just like the Air Force has 18-year-old kids fixing jets. That's just that he's doing it on a carrier and under conditions that are different. I always thought, like in Hunt for Red October, that the real hero of that movie is Jonesy, the sonar man who detects this weird noise. He didn't know what it was, right? I mean, isn't that where that starts? So let's play up the Jonesies of the fleet. You know, that again, the stories out there from these young kids, the flight deck crews, the people on the submarines. You know, those are stories that need to get told, and you know, we keep focusing on the airplane drivers and occasionally we'll have some movie about SWOs fighting monsters from outer space on a battleship that hasn't seen action in 100 years. But you know, other than that, we're doing great as far as the recruiting stuff. It, you know, we need to jazz up our message. Not everybody in the Navy is a SEAL. That's fine. We don't need everybody to be a SEAL, but there are those people who are doing really important work that we need to just kind of. And there must be some way to do that it was wouldn't come across as hokey. But you know, I always love the Marines, because Marines are saying, you know, we get to go do all this stuff. Who gets them there? Who takes the Marines from point A to point B so they can do those things that, you know, so they can run to the sound of the guns or whatever their motto is. So, you know, that's the Navy mission, and we've managed to deliver them successfully for a few hundred years now. So, need to tell that story.
Yeah, we have a great story. You know, everybody could sit around and tell sea stories all day, and we're not telling sea stories. We're talking about other things. We're not selling ourselves very well. Either in Congress or in the public space. So I think it's time to break that down to parade rest and rebuild it, because it's simply not working. And there's some accountability there too, which I think, you know, we're going to have a new CNO in the next year. And I don't think the present CNO is going to do much to change, being that this has kind of been on his watch. But there'll be an opportunity for the new CNO, whoever that is. Hopefully that'll be one of their focuses, because if you don't have... When you don't have a big enough pool coming in, you take what you can, which means you're taking in a lower quality person. That's just the way the math works. If you have no selectability, then you're not very selective. So we need to have a larger pool of people who are interested in coming to the Navy, so we can select the people that we want to. And we don't have to start changing standards simply to be able to get people on there. And you know, we'll have to make other adjustments too to get that number. I just hope the response isn't, okay, everybody, you're now not going to be manned at 80%. You're going to be manned at 60%. I don't think that's the answer. We've got to bring the people in to do the job. Otherwise, we know how that works out in the end. One last story on accountability, which I wanted to bring to the listeners. We talked about it a little bit in the pre-show. I caught bits and pieces, which, you know, Russian PO'd them. I remember back in the Cold War days, the Soviet Pacific Fleet was kind of the you had the Red Banner Northern Fleet, always got all the good stuff. Then the Pacific Fleet, and then the Baltic Fleet came up third. Maybe the Black Sea was fourth. I don't know. But the Pacific Fleet commander, let's see if I can get his name right here, Admiral Sergei Avankas. He's been in the job since 2012. Well, they had a couple of the media reports said they had a snap exercise. Nothing's snap in Russia, but maybe they did. But they had an exercise here a few weeks ago. Well, when it was done, they relieved the commander who'd been in the job for the last 11 years. I think they're sending him off to Russian equivalent, from what I read, of the junior ROTC, and they're going to replace him with the Baltic Sea commander, who's only been in the job for a couple of years. So it's either having learned their lessons of not holding their senior officers accountable for readiness, and Ukraine is helping the Russians rethink how they hold their senior leaders accountable in other places. Are there some palace intrigue going on? I don't think it's palace intrigue, because this guy was sent off to the Pacific Fleet in 2012. There's no power base out there on the other side of Asia. I just thought that was an interesting story that kind of bookends a fleet commander who has less than stellar performance. Well, it wasn't our Navy, but it was a Navy.
Yeah, he's the, you know, what if you threw a readiness exercise and nobody showed up ready? I mean, it's the story. We had the same story when they did the readiness stuff on our ready reserve fleet or whatever it was that.
Oh yeah.
What Sal, you know, and I don't know if we held anybody accountable. Did we fire anybody over that? I mean, you know,
we didn't.
I think what 10% of our ships were capable of getting to undersea. I can't remember the exact figure Sal Macargiano knows, but you know, where is the accountability for the leaders who are you know, for finding things aren't ready and all that? Whose heads are being sent to the junior ROTC billets in Keokuk, Iowa? Don't know, but that's how you get people. Start of World War II, both Army and Navy went through a lot of commanders who were probably really good at their jobs in peacetime, but didn't exactly hack it during wartime. And I hate to think we're going to have to go through that again down the road, but we'll see. Yeah. It's amazing how many programs get cut when you're going to. Sorry.
Yeah, we probably will. I think you're right. It's going to take something like that. I have read a couple of articles in the last few months. We were talking about how, you know, the Russians, as they do, they are a learning institution, and maybe this is maybe I'm giving them too much credit. Maybe this is a manifestation of a new attitude they have towards, you know, quit gun decking your readiness reports. We're going to do surprise inspections. An admiral I once worked for, he took over command from a guy who used to blowtorch people who would CAS rep, and his attitude was, I want you to CAS rep, and it took him a long time to change the attitude of people. It's like, why is it that CAS rep? Well, we didn't know. It's like CAS rep it. So, again, it's all about attitude and leadership and things of that manner, as it always is in this line of business. Well, hey, here's an hour. We always joke that we have no problem filling up an hour.
That's true, and because we can pontificate with the best of them.
And if everybody is sticking with us to this end, I'll let you know next week we're actually going to get – we'll help you get your JPME signed off. We're going to go joint next week. We're actually bringing on board definitely a U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel – Matt Errol, and maybe some of his co-authors, I think a Marine Corps officer may be joining us as well. He recently wrote an article you can find over at, I think, Modern War Institute is where you can find it, Graveyard of the Command Posts, which I think what he talks about in this article directly translates to the maritime and the air domain, really everything. It has to do with one of the lessons that they are taking out of the Russo-Ukrainian war, and that is, and anybody who has served in our wars of the last 20 years know what I'm talking about. Our forward deployed command posts have gotten huge, and they leak electrons all over the place, and we've gotten a little complacent about how dangerous that can be. And not just to our generals and our admirals, but for the ability to command forces in the field. So they've looked at the challenge, look at some of the things that we're doing, some of the lessons, have a few things. So we're going to have them on next week to talk about that if you all wanted to read up ahead of time. Also, if you're still with us, that tells me that you're a fan of Midrats and you like hearing us talk. If you haven't already, please go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, and give us a 5-star review. Put a couple of nice comments on there. Don't give us a 4-star because you're modest. The reason why we want to do that, not because we have tender egos, which we might, but because when you give us a 5-star review and you say a couple of things that you like about the show, it in their search engine, it ups us in the national security arena. And if you like Midrats, you'd want other people to find us as well. And when they're searching for things involving the Navy or the military, we're more likely to pop up above the fold, and then they can come enjoy Midrats like you do. So that's kind of my altar call for the day. You got anything else for us there, Eagle One?
No, just thank everybody for being here today, and we'll meet them down the road.
Perfect, and we'll see everybody next week. And until then, Hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Hoping you're the same.